From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, a look at the international situation with Mark Sloboda, senior lecturer at Moscow State University on international relations. We spoke with him via Skype from Moscow on Friday. Well, Mark, it's been a few weeks, but welcome back.
Don, thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on public radio.
And ours too. Thank you. I guess we have a lot of ground to cover. Let's start with the D-Day snub from Washington and London, particularly London, who benefited greatly from the millions of casualties suffered by the Soviet Union taking out Nazis that would otherwise be cruising around London probably today.
Yeah, so this was a pretty remarkable snub, because you would think that historical remembrance of World War II and, you know, the contributions of all the Allies and the history of it would be above politics, above the politics of the moment, you know, above domestic politics, above spats, personal spats, you know, even above current geopolitics. But that is obviously not the case. This year was a pretty, a big anniversary year. So it was the 75th anniversary of D-Day, of the Allied landing on Normandy, that finally, in the what was already the closing years of the war, began the second front against Germany, something that Stalin had been pushing for years.
Yep.
Because Soviet boys and girls were doing the dying, while the U.S. and U.K. sent some lend-lease aid that the Soviet Union still had to pay off, right? You know, trust capitalists to make profit off of sending Soviet boys and girls die to defeat fascism for them, but that's what happened. And of course, it's usually presented as some kind of they died, but we sent them lend-lease.
Right.
That's nice. The extent of it is often over exaggerated. Well, the same can be said here in Russia. It's usually laughed off even too much. The jokes here being that they sent toy Sherman tanks that couldn't be used on the Eastern Front, and because they were such toys compared to the Russian and German tanks that were doing battle. And they had to be sent off to guard the border against Japan because Japan didn't have any tanks of any note. So they sent Spam, and they sent gold braid for uniforms.
Ooh.
that's usually what they talk about here. Now, of course, it's also true that they did send munitions, and they sent oil and diesel. That was not an insignificant quality. So it's both much less than the way the West presents it, and a little bit more than the way it's often presented in Russia today. But it's undeniable the fact that the Soviet boys and girls did the dying, to a total of some 20 to 30 million, while the Yanks stayed at home and the Brits were retreated back to their little island after Dunkirk. So anyway, it's the 75th anniversary of D-Day. In 2014, just 5 years ago, on the 70th anniversary, Putin was there. He was invited. This time he wasn't. And what changed, of course, is modern geopolitics, and it's seen as a snub. Although it's not only a snub against Putin, because none of the leaders of other Soviet countries, Soviet successor states, were invited. The new comedian president of Ukraine, Vladimir Zelensky, he wasn't invited. Batka, Alexander Lukashenko, the quote, last dictator in Europe from Belarus, he wasn't invited. No one was invited from Kazakhstan or any other states of Central Asia. So it was really an attempt to downplay, you know, once again, you know, the instrumentality of the Soviet role in World War II to defeat Nazi Germany, such that many historians refer to it more as a Soviet-Nazi war than anything else. The argument being used is that the Soviet Union wasn't technically involved in the D-Day landing, although if the there were some 10 to 15 subpar undermanned divisions, German divisions in the West, when the UK and the US did the D-Day landing.
That's because that's all that was left.
That was all that was left. In the Eastern Front, the Soviet Union was chewing up some 280 German divisions and the other 100 divisions of their allied fascist East European countries, Romania, right, and Hungary and the Baltic states and Finland and so on. So right, that is the, you know, the scale of it. So obviously D-Day would not have happened if the Soviet Union wasn't taking the majority of the brunt right at the same time,
right,
and for several years beforehand. In fact, I mean, this is the reality of the situation, that the reason 3 years after the beginning of the war that the U.S. finally stepped in and there was the D-Day landings was because the Germans were already being routed in defeat across Eastern Europe. And the U.S. and the U.K. were afraid that if they let it go too much longer, then the Soviet Union would roll right past Germany and be the ones to liberate France and Western Europe. That's the reality of the situation, right? And let's be clear. I mean, the U.K. and the U.S. did everything possible to try to, from Munich and, you know, all the other, appeasements and the repeated refusals prior to the war when Stalin was begging them to form an anti-German alliance, to put blocking forces in Poland. And the Soviet Union was always refused. Why? Because the West wanted Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union to go to war and exhaust and hopefully destroy each other.
That
is well known. I mean, all you have to do is take a look at, you know, the leaders of the time, Churchill and others, memoirs and notes. They won, and Stalin Truman was terrified of that.
Yeah.
Stalin was terrified that he would get lured into fighting a war against Germany alone, that he was afraid the Soviet Union couldn't win because Germany was, you know, one of the most industrial and technologically powerful countries in the world at that time.
That's right. Yep.
So, but that was the point. I mean, I got here a quote by Harry Truman.
Exactly.
He was then senator, right? He would go on to be president. But he perfectly summarized the U.S. position speaking in the New York Times in June of 1941. Right, when the war had started in earnest.
Yeah.
If we see that Germany is winning, we ought to help Russia.
Right.
And if Russia is winning, we ought to help Germany.
That's right.
And that way, let them kill as many as possible of each other.
That's right. That's what he was saying. That while Operation Barbarossa was rolling.
Yes, yes.
That's June of 1941.
So, anyway... The history of it aside, Putin wasn't invited this year. No countries of the former Soviet Union were represented. And if you take a look at polling, the populations today, in May of 1945, 57% of French people believed that the Soviet Union was the biggest contributor the defeat of Germany in saving France at the end of the war. 57%. 20% said the U.S. and 12% said the U.K. Today, in 2004, this is already 15 years ago, the number is, but Only 20% of French people believe that the Soviet Union had played the biggest part and paid the, you know, the biggest price in the defeat of Nazi Germany. And 58% said of French people said that the U.S. played the biggest role.
Amazing.
So, amazing. I mean, that really raises the question. Who actually won World War II?
Yeah.
Was it the Soviet Union or was it Hollywood?
Yeah. You know, more specifically, was it the anti-fascist forces or was it fascism?
Yeah. I mean, was it, I mean, we often say that victors write history.
Right.
Well, we can see clearly, at least in this case, it's not victors writing history. It's those with hegemonic narrative control.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Of media that write history.
Yeah, that's
usually, you know, it that coincides with the winners, but not in the particulars of this case. So anyway, Putin was snubbed from the D-Day celebrations, but he sent a very clear message, because while the Western leaders, and Angela Merkel was there, because I guess technically Germany did participate in DD, although those were the ones, you know, that were being attacked and that were defending their occupation of France at the time. So while all the Western leaders are gathered on the beaches of Normandy without, you know, any representative of the successor states of the Soviet Union, President Putin is greeting the president of China, Xi Jinping, in a state ceremony, you know, where the two are seen very clearly together. You know, then, of course, he goes on to continue to go to the St. Petersburg Economic Forum the next day. The Chinese president calls Putin his closest friend. And the Chinese ambassador to Russia speaks of the golden age of China-Russia relations. And the Washington Post is writing headlines talking about the Chinese-Russian alliance. So the question to the West, with Putin being snubbed from the D-Day ceremony, is where was Putin instead? And did you get the message? Could Russia be any clearer with that message?
You
had the West in Normandy and you had the powers of the East. And actually, you can't forget the Chinese contribution and the Chinese losses, which were even greater than the Soviet Union's in World War II, albeit against the Japanese instead. So we had the winners of the East, you know, and those who suffered the most from World War II.
Right.
Gathering together on their own once again, and the leaders of the West gathering on their own. And it has to be said that exclusion comes from the leaders of the West.
Yeah, what's interesting also, there's, you know, the context for the meeting with Putin and Xi, you know, now is the Economic Forum in St. Petersburg. But even when they're in Moscow, there's a whole conversation about all these different business and commercial, you know, things that are, you know, going on as part of the geopolitical universe landscape. And with the U.S., when they're meeting with the, you know, they're celebrating with the French and the Brits, it's all militarized. It's, you know, in other words, Xi and Putin are sitting down talking about business. They're talking about Huawei and, you know, all this other stuff. And
the One Belt One Road,
that
the renovation, the northern sea route
for small
above
business.
The Arctic,
yep,
you know,
all of it,
investments
yeah.
and energy.
Yep.
Meanwhile, relations between the U.S. and Russia is all about the military and the U.S. relations and sanctions, economic warfare.
Yeah, right.
And the U.S. relations with China are all about the military,
right.
i.e. doing military parades in the South China Sea off the Chinese coast, naval parades, you know, under the guise of freedom of navigation exercises, and a gigantic economic tariff war. That just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger and is threatening to bring the whole world down into recession, if not depression, because it's escalating so far.
Yeah, so it's wild. You have these incidents, the one today in the East China Sea, the one the other day near Syria, between, you know, basically with the U.S. provocations of, or in any event, contact between U.S. and Russian, you know, military forces out in the field. Yeah. Pretty much.
These are now regular occurrences. These Cold War era confrontations are now regular.
Right.
Every month, the U.S. is probing, you know, with both naval and spy craft in the Black Sea and the Baltic Sea.
Right.
Again, on the other side of the world from the United States, right up on Russia's borders.
Right.
And in Syria, they are probing the Russian bases there, and of course the Syrian government essentially every day, this is particularly problematic for Russia because Russia's bases there, particularly Haiman, the air base, are being attacked by the jihadists, led by completely controlled at this point by Al Qaeda, now known as Hayat Tahrir al Sham, out of Idlib. And they're being attacked with rockets and with drones. And the Russian government has commented on multiple occasions that they're showing a degree of sophistication and intelligence. Surveillance and satellite,
right,
and reconnaissance plane gathered intelligence that they should not have.
Right.
And Russia is, of course, concerned that the U.S., possibly through intermediaries, is basically passing targeting information about their bases,
right,
onto Al-Qaeda.
That's a reasonable assumption based. First, they probe our defenses with their spy craft,
yeah, right,
and then these guys know where the holes are.
Yeah, and that is a deadly serious issue. And it's even more deadly serious because Israel is regularly attacking Syria, illegally, in violation of international law, Syria's sovereignty, regularly, to the point where no one even really bats an eye, to see every 2 weeks, 2 or 3 weeks, that Israel is launching air and missile strikes in Syria. Yeah. And in one of those, in the last few months, in the crossfire that ensued when Syrian air defense, tried to defend their country, a Russian plane was shot down in this basic area where this incident happened off the coast of Syria. And it was, again, on the other side of the world from the U.S., a Poseidon, a P-8A surveillance aircraft, a naval surveillance aircraft, a spy plane, was right up on it was still in international waters, but it was right up on the Syrian border, right across from Russia's naval base at Tartus, when they were intercepted by a Su-35. And this is exactly where, in this area here, where this Russian plane was shot down in this crossfire with the Israelis, leading to a loss of all hands. So, the Russians are under attack by Al-Qaeda, by the Israelis, in Syria, not to mention the U.S. occupation of the east of the country, of course. This is a deadly serious military security issue for them that these U.S. spy planes are routinely probing their defenses. And we had this incident in the South China Sea just in the last 20, or sorry, the East China Sea in the last 24, where a Russian warship there, drills with the Chinese, was in an incident with a U.S. naval ship, and both are blaming each other for unprofessional movements, that caused a mere collision, 50 meters separating the two ships.
Yep.
This is the type of Cold War era brinksmanship and that is going on once again, and this is really entirely unnecessary if the point is something other than global hegemony. Of course, if the point is global hegemony, then you have to contain in, China and Russia. But
right.
If the point isn't global hegemony, none of this is actually necessary.
Right.
Whether it's in Syria or the South China Sea, or the Baltics or the Black Sea or
none of it makes sense if the goal isn't hegemony. Really, I mean, there's not another scenario under which it makes any sense.
Yeah. There's the whole argument there about what is really in the American people's best national security interests. Is it really militarized global hegemony with hundreds of thousands of troops being deployed overseas and knocking over governments left and right and regime changing invasions, occupations? Is that really in Americans' interests, or is that in the interests of a ruling elite with a certain vision of an American-dominated world, in terms military, economic, media, and cultural, et cetera.
I mean, I think they took had an election on that question. You didn't get to hear it very loudly, but that's what Trump was saying, and he was elected, and it's hard to figure out too many other reasons why, other than him saying the military costs too much, we're involved in too many damned wars, maybe we should be focusing on trying to make money.
Unfortunately, the truth is most Americans, Trump voters or others, don't vote on foreign policy. They don't even notice on foreign. And it has to be said that most countries are that way. Most countries, people are more concerned with what's going on in their pocketbooks. And while there may be a very small online activist base of these new, if you want to call them alt-right Trump supporters, who do care very much about his anti-regime change campaign message, I think they are a distinct minority.
We have
to remember that George Bush and Barack Obama both also campaigned on declarations of being, we will cease foreign policy entanglements and concentrate more on affairs in our own country, to varying degrees. And so all three of them lied or this simply the office of the presidency and the deep state in control of the country prevent intention from ever becoming a policy reality.
I think that Trump's message when it was being articulated was the reason for this had nothing to do other than the fact it costs too damn much money, and so make the allies pay more, let people participate in their own self defense more. Let's look at international security as a multipolar obligation rather than being the policeman of the world. That was kind of the messaging that went with it, which centers not so much on war and peace issues to people that aren't concerned with that, but rather pocketbook. And yet, he had a record budget right away for the military and went on with that stupid, the $1 trillion they're going to spend on quote-unquote modernizing nuclear weapons, et cetera. So,
Yeah, so I guess the other thing that I think is of note this week in particular is what's going on in Idlib.
Yes.
And Russia and the Syrian government have begun a serious offensive this time against the jihadi forces in Idlib, which even the Western media, when they're really pressed to it, will admit that Idlib at this point is entirely controlled by Hayat Tahrir al-Sham and their allies like the Turkestan Islamic Party. And even the U.S. government admits when pressed that Hayat Tahrir al-Sham is al-Qaeda in Syria. That is the official U.S. position. So the Russian and Syrian government are attacking al-Qaeda in Idlib. Trump is screaming that the attacks must stop because of innocent children being killed, although he wasn't too concerned when U.S. forces were bombing Mosul and Raqqa and Kobani and Fallujah into the ground to get rid of other jihadis, ISIS there. Al-Qaeda is a different story, and Russia and Syria a different story because, you know, interests, because it's to America's interest to see Syria and Russia tied up with an Al-Qaeda statelet. I mean, this is the largest Al-Qaeda concentration in history of the world, right? Terrorist concentration. Right. They basically control, you know, an entire province and indeed areas outside of that province. And there was a kind of a ceasefire agreement brokered between Russia and Turkey over Idlib. And this was called the Sochi Memorandum. Mm-hmm. And I spoke out on this show against it when it happened. And here we are now, nearly 9 months later. Turkey has not fulfilled one of its commitments,
as you said,
to that agreement. There was supposed to be a DMZ, a buffer zone created. And hardcore jihadists like Al-Qaeda, which now controls the entire area, and the Turkestan Islamic Party, were supposed to be removed from that border area. Heavy weapons from all the other forces were supposed to be removed from that area. The important M4 highway from Latakia to Aleppo was supposed to be open. There were supposed to be joint Russian-Turkish patrols. None of this has happened, right? Instead, what we see is headlines like on Reuters, Turkey sends weapons to Syrian rebels facing Russian-backed assault. We see Al Jazeera, Turkish-backed rebels come to the aid. Turkish-backed rebels join forces with HTS rebels, because that's what we call Al-Qaeda, evidently. HTS rebels. Uh-huh. Hayat Tahrir al-Sham rebels, right? I remember when those rebels attacked us on 9/11, at the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, but here we have HTS rebels and Al Jazeera. Turkey-backed fighters join forces with HTS rebels in Idlib. And the same thing in The National, talking about Turkey sending arms Turkish arms bolster Syrian rebels on front lines of Russian-backed assault on Idlib. So, what I've long talked about, you know, Al-Qaeda, you know, and their allies in Idlib are still not under the direct control of the Turkish government, like other jihadists. Such as the National Liberation, they've all been joined together in a Turkish proxy, uniformed proxy force called the National Liberation Front. Mm-hmm. And they're based out of the Turkish occupied area of Syria over the Jarablus corridor in Afrin. And Al-Qaeda, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham and its allies directly control adjacent Idlib and a few surrounding areas. Again, right on the Turkish border. And they're supplied by Turkey. They receive daily supplies of fuel, food, all right, arms, supplies, because, you know, Al-Qaeda doesn't really produce much in Idlib, I hate to tell you, by Turkey, right? And this is going on. And Turkey is bolstering them now with heavy weapons to defend against this assault. And it has to be said that where Russian has bombed, where the Syrian forces are moving in, this is only right in the border areas outside of Idlib proper, i.e. Bordering Latakia in the west, Hama in the south, and Aleppo province in the east, into this Turkish-Russia agreed on DMZ, right, where they're already supposed to have been removed by Turkey, which of course never happened. And Turkey and the U.S. are loudly protesting over this.
Let me just say, there's so many damn contradictions in the middle of all of this, too, and we're out of time, so we're going to maybe we can pick up next week and explore that. Because you've got this S-400 deal, you got the U.S. with the fighter training, they're going to cancel that. And you've had Turkey, on the other hand, being the most aggressive against it. They actually shot down Russian planes, as we recall, and and all of that. So we'll come back to this next week and hope that it doesn't explode between now and then.
Yeah, well, I'm not really. It's exploding right now. It's just exploding below the lines of the Western media at this point.
And as everything of consequence does. Right, Mark, thank you very much. It's a pleasure speaking to you again. Thanks, man. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.